This is OBG Project's Grand Rounds Live, a podcast of the OBG Project's monthly webinar featuring cutting-edge OB and GYN topics. Our Grand Rounds Live webinar is free for OBG First members. With an OBG First membership, you have access to the webinar slides, handouts, and future Grand Rounds Live webinars. To learn more about membership and other perks of an OBG First membership, go to obgproject.com/get first. Enjoy the webinar.
Hi, everybody. This is Rebecca Dunsmore-Sue. I am here to welcome you to the third in our series of OBG Project Grand Rounds. Really excited about this topic. It's something that's an important area to me. And as in case you haven't noticed, there's a pattern. We're going gyn OB. So it's gyn week or gyn month this month. Just quickly before I introduce today's speaker, I just wanted to mention that next month's topic, obviously OB, is going to be shoulder dystocia with Dr. Margaret Dow. So we'll look forward to that as well. So today, I am thrilled to introduce Dr. Carrie Zapata. She is an associate professor of OBGYN at the University of Virginia. She did her undergraduate degree at Duke University, her master's in public health from the University of Hawaii, and her MD at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Her residency was at Vanderbilt in Nashville. She, at the University of at UVA, has started a multidisciplinary vulvar skin disorders clinic and a multidisciplinary gender-affirming surgery clinic. So she is an excellent expert at this. She's been with UVA her entire post-residency career, except for 12 months where she actually practiced in New Zealand, which is very exciting. With no further ado, I would like to say welcome, Carrie, and I can't wait to hear this talk.
Great. Thanks, Rebecca. I'm going to fast forward here. Well, thank you for having me. And this has become one of my primary interests at UVA. I've had a long time interested in it since I was a resident, and I'm excited that I've been learning more as I've become a real doctor. And feel like I have a good handle on it now, and I'm happy to share what I know. But I know, as with so many things in OBGYN, there's always more to know. And sometimes there's not a lot of great treatments or a lot of great studies to push you along the right path. And sometimes just talking to more people, hearing more things, sometimes hearing the same thing over and over again is helpful. So I just wanted to give you an update. And today I'm gonna focus on the lichens. And I also wanted to touch on some other disorders, skin disorders and vulvodynia, but in the interest of time, we may not get to those. And so there is a handout that you can select in the GoTo webinar panel under handouts. There's two of them. The second one is a handout that we made for you that has the highlights from my slides. So you don't have to take notes. You can just download the handout and print that out. And it has the dosages and treatment regimens that are in my slides. So I hope that's helpful. So I have no disclosures. And I think the objectives were listed elsewhere when you registered. So before we start about specific vulvar skin conditions, I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about vulvar care, because in every vulvar skin condition, the most important thing is talking to women about how to take care of their vulva. And this is kind of what we start with every patient. And so the most important thing in our clinic is we talk about getting a sitz bath, an actual sitz bath. And I have one pictured here from Amazon that folds up and sits under the sink. And we advise patients that they should fill it with warm water, not hot, not cold, no salts, just water, and put it in the toilet seat and sit up to three times a day if they're able. If they can just sit for 1 minute, sit for 1 minute. If they're able to sit for longer, that's even better. But we tell them that this is more important. A lot of patients will say, oh, but I have a bathtub, I'll put water in the bathtub. But in reality, they won't do it as frequently as you tell them to do. So the sitz bath is much easier. Once they get out of the bath, they need to pat dry and apply a thin layer of petroleum jelly. They should not use a hairdryer on the vulva. Just pat dry, be gentle with the skin. And then we talk about avoiding irritants. And it's important that you ask patients what they're using on their vulva. inevitably they're bothered by something, itching, burning, pain. And so they've tried something. They've tried something over the counter. They've read about something. They've tried it. So it's really important that you ask them what they're using right now. And if you determine that they're using any Vagisil products, you really want to advise them against that. And I heard this the other day. Vagisil makes you ill and benzocaine brings you pain. It's a good reminder that these products are kind of evil. The benzocaines, they anesthetize the skin, so they make it feel better initially, and then there's a severe rebound where they feel like they have to put more on, and then that can cause a contact dermatitis that can be quite severe. So really avoiding those products. The other thing to remember is that yeast makes everything worse. So any patient that's coming in complaining of vulvar pain or itching, it's important to do a fungal culture and or a wet prep and determine if yeast is a component of their symptoms. If they do have yeast present, then the treatment that we use is fluconazole 200 milligrams twice weekly for 1 week, and then once weekly suppression for 6 weeks after that. Alternatively, they can use boric acid. And usually we do twice weekly boric acid suppositories for suppression. Another tenet of vulvar care is always choosing an ointment over a cream. So a lot of things, including clobetasol, come as a cream. And creams have more ingredients in them, more things that might cause a patient to have a reaction to it. So whenever you're prescribing something, always make sure it's an ointment and not a cream. So let's start with the lichens. And the lichens, as you know, come in three varieties: simplex chronicus, sclerosis, and planus. And we're going to talk about each of those. We're also going to talk about what to do when clobetasol doesn't work, when you should biopsy, and when and who to refer to who might be able to help you when you're stuck. So this is a patient who's been complaining of vulvar irritation and pain for over 6 months. She comes in with this exam, and immediately you notice that she has a little bit of loss of architecture of the labia minora. It's not terrible. Maybe there's a little bit of hypertrophy above the clitoris. I know it's hard to tell from this picture if there's any phimosis there, but it's relatively normal. But one thing I want you to notice at the top of the picture is that she's got these linear excoriations from scratching. So this patient has been biopsied, and her biopsies are consistent with lichen simplex chronicus. Sometimes you really get a pretty normal exam in lichen simplex chronicus. A history of lots of itching, irritation without objective findings should make you think about lichen simplex chronicus. And as you know, the important thing here is trying to break that itch-scratch cycle. But the important question is, well, what started the itch-scratch cycle? What's that inciting event? There's lots of things that can cause a patient to go down this track. And so your job is to figure out, well, what is it? Is there yeast present? Are there other skin findings elsewhere on the body? I always ask about other places that itch, including the scalp, elbows, knees, if you can't see them. And then again, the list of things that they're using on their vulva. As I mentioned, they can have whitening and thickening that makes you think, oh, maybe it's lichen sclerosis. Importantly, they'll tell you that it gets worse with heat and humidity and stress. So treatment-wise, again, we go back to the vulvar care. These women really do respond to coolness, cool temperatures. Cool compresses at night can be helpful. Bleach baths can also be helpful. So the regimen is there, 1 teaspoon in a gallon of water, and that sits back 2 to 3 times a week. And that just gets rid of any yeast or bacteria that might be on the skin. And it's so dilute that it's safe to use. If you see inflammation that's present, redness and some induration or erythema, you can think about adding an anti-inflammatory antibody. And then we do use steroids for this. But for lichen simplex chronicus, you don't want to use steroids for a long time. If you start with clobetasol, you want to titrate down quickly to triamcinolone or hydrocortisone. And you can do a pulse, so 2 to 3 weeks of using it every night. But then it should be, you know, a couple of times a week, and then only when they're itching. They shouldn't be putting it on all the time. So what if you tried these things and it's not getting better? Well, if you haven't biopsied it, then now's the time to do so. Make sure that you're on the right track, you know what you're dealing with. You can also consider a short course of oral steroids. Sometimes you really need oral steroids to calm things down. And the same thing for intralesional or intramuscular steroids. So usually we use triamcinolone, and I have a slide later about how to do this. You can also consider tacrolimus or pimecrolimus. And then think about sedation. I usually ask patients, well, when is it that you itch the most? Is it the nighttime or the daytime? Is it equal? And then think about some sort of sedating agent that might help them cope with that itching. So at nighttime, there's a list of medications that we often try. In the daytime, SSRIs can be helpful. And then gabapentin, which we typically think for pain, can also be helpful for itching. And just remember that if you start a patient on gabapentin, you have to taper it up and taper it down if they're not finding it helpful. And it can take 4 to 5 weeks before you really know if there's a benefit. And then lastly, think about counseling. A lot of these patients, again, you're trying to break that itch scratch cycle. So what things can they do? Who can they work with to try to modify their behavior so they're not scratching quite as much? So here's another lichen. This patient you can see has some hyperkeratosis on the labia majora. She's got loss of the hair. And when you look a little bit closer, she has loss of the architecture. You don't see any of the labia minora. She's got phimosis over the clitoris. And this patient has lichen sclerosis. Patients with lichen sclerosis will also oftentimes have extragenital lesions. Obviously, we're not used to looking at other parts of the body, but if you go looking for it, you may find it in other places. Sometimes patients will come to you because they've already seen a dermatologist and been diagnosed with extragenital lichen sclerosis. So it's always interesting to just ask patients to show you kind of the area that's bothered so you can learn. So lichen sclerosis, as you know, has a bimodal age distribution, but really you can see it at any age. So if you see a patient in her 30s who's got, that cigarette paper lesion or loss of labial architecture, is complaining about itching, you should still think about lichen sclerosis. And then it's also important to note that you can see bruising and purpura, especially in postmenopausal women, as we saw in that last patient. If this question always comes up, if I think it's lichen sclerosis, it looks like lichen sclerosis, do I have to biopsy it to prove that it's lichen sclerosis? And the answer is no. It's okay to start with high potency steroids and see if it gets better. But if it doesn't get better, then you should biopsy it. So our tenets of treating lichen sclerosis, again, going back to that vulvar care, and then we also talk about clobetasol. So for lichen sclerosis, you do want to use clobetasol and either once to twice daily, depending on their presenting symptoms. Twice daily if they're having really severe itching, an impressive exam. If it's just kind of moderate, then you can do once daily and taper off, and the taper is there. Importantly, patients need to be maintained on clobetasol indefinitely. So they need to use it once to twice weekly, even if they're not having itching. Now, a lot of these women will also have fissures or painful areas that you can find on exam if you really look closely. And if they're complaining of one particular spot that really bothers them, you see a fissure, then we recommend using mupirocin as well as the clobetasol. So we use mupirocin twice daily for 5 to 7 days. And it's usually pretty easy. You just tell patients, just put it on that one spot that really bothers you, tends to sting, not the mupirocin, but that spot. And so they know right where they want to put it. And then clobetasol to the rest of the vulva or the areas that are involved with the lichen sclerosis. This is a place where if you take a picture of their vulva and they're comfortable looking at it, you have a mirror in the office, or even just a diagram of the vulva, you can tell them exactly where you want them to put the clobetasol. And then if you haven't put the patient on estrogen already, if they're not using vaginal estrogen, think about adding that as well. A lot of these patients are postmenopausal and they will benefit from the vaginal estrogen. So when you first diagnose a patient with lichen sclerosis, I think it's important to establish the prognosis, to tell them kind of what to expect. And you can get improvement with clobetasol. That's why we start with it, and improvement rates are actually pretty good. You can also get complete remission. In the literature, 23 to 54% of the time, you can see complete remission with clobetasol. Unfortunately, lichen sclerosis can progress to squamous cell cancer. And I think in the beginning slides that mentioned 5%, I think that's what you can use to counsel patients. 5% of patients who don't treat their lichen sclerosis may progress to a squamous cell cancer. Importantly, though, women who use maintenance therapy once or twice weekly will not develop squamous cell cancer. At least that's what we've seen in the literature so far. So that's just a motivating factor to try to get patients to do their maintenance therapy. It is important, I think, that if you see a patient who's already got scarring, she's got agglutination of the labia, she's got phimosis over the clitoris, she's got narrowing of the vagina, her risk of complete or her chance of complete remission is much, much lower. So women who already have scarring are much less likely to see this go away. So I just wanted to show you some pictures of kind of ongoing treatment, and this patient has the purpurin ecchymosis, but really kind of minimal ongoing treatment or ongoing disease, lichen sclerosis disease. She continues to have agglutination of the labia minora and labia majora. She's got phimosis over the clitoris. And with use of clobetasol, unfortunately, that's not going to return. What you're trying to do is stabilize it and prevent it from getting worse. And here's another patient who's doing really well with her clobetasol, but again, that architecture does not return. So what if it's not getting better with clobetasol? Well, the first thing you should talk to patients about is compliance. Are they really doing what you've asked them to do? If you find that they're not, if you can get them to commit to doing like the clobetasol for 3 to 4 weeks and really do what you've asked them to do, and they're truly not getting better, then it's time to move on to something else. Another thing to think about is urinary incontinence. A lot of postmenopausal women have urinary incontinence, and they may be using a pad. That's going to irritate the vulva, or they're getting wet. That's going to irritate the vulva. So is there more that can be done to treat their incontinence? That may be helpful. Next, I think, and you know, shouldn't be third down on the list, but sexual health counseling is super important. These women have a lot of anxiety about sexual health, especially postmenopausal women. In my practice, I have several who are reconnecting with people they met when they were in middle school, and they're, you know, starting a new relationship, and they're really anxious about how that's going to go. So I refer these right off the bat to a sexual health counselor. And then again, vaginal estrogen can be helpful. Other things to think about, desoxymetazone. So some women, and a lot of women, will report burning with clobetasol. And some women will actually either develop an allergy to it or intolerance of it. And so in our practice, we will switch some women over to desoxymetazone. And someone who's really saying, you know, that I don't feel good when I put the clobetasol on, what we'll do is we'll also prescribe the desoxymetazone. We'll have them apply it to the inside of their arm. One on each arm, the clobetasol and the desoxymetazone, and do that daily for a week. And if they see redness and irritation around the clobetasol, that tells you, yep, they're not doing well with the clobetasol. They either have an allergy or an intolerance to it. Tacrolimus is another good option, and that will cause burning in about 20% of patients. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Intralesional triamcinolone, again, is also a good option, and then CO2 laser that I want to talk. That's another thing I want to talk about. So tacrolimus is a steroid-sparing agent. It suppresses T-cell activation, and it's an off-label use for the management of lichen sclerosis. And you ask patients to apply a thin layer. We usually start with a 0.1% ointment, and it can be applied once to twice daily, up to 4 times daily in patients who tolerate it. As I mentioned, it can cause burning, and that should improve after initial use. So you want to warn patients about that. If they have any fissures at the time that you're starting to prescribe it, I probably would hold off, use the clobetasol first, and then switch them over to the tacrolimus, because it is really going to burn if they have any fissures. Other things to reduce the burning, refrigeration, and you can apply it over petroleum jelly in the beginning, and then as they do better with it, you can have them use the petroleum jelly less. And then there's also a 0.03% ointment that you can start with and then work up to the 0.1. You should know there's a box warning on it. Rare cases of malignancy have been reported, but there's also cases of malignancy associated with lichen sclerosus. So not a close association, but there is a box warning. And in a head-to-head study with clobetasol, more patients showed improvement with clobetasol, and more patients who used tacrolimus reported burning as a side effect. But you can see here, 48% of those in the clobetasol group also noted burning. So you kind of get it either way. This is a picture from that study comparing clobetasol and tacrolimus, obviously not in the same patient, but it just kind of shows you the effect that you get with each. Notably, I think you get a little bit more loss of architecture with the tacrolimus. I believe the patient on the left is pre-menarchal, if I had to guess. So not a great head-to-head comparison, but I think a good picture of what the tacrolimus can look like over time. So intralesional injections, we use triamcinolone 10 milligrams per milliliter. You shouldn't use more than 40 milligrams max on the entire vulva, and generally you would repeat it monthly for 3 to 4 months in the specific area that's bothering the patient. There's limited data on this, but it can help decrease their pain and itching, and it's generally real well tolerated. Patients usually won't let you inject their vulva more than 3 to 4 times when they have vulvar pain, but it can improve symptoms pretty quickly. So I wanted to spend a minute talking about CO2 lasers. If you picked up this month's Green Journal, you saw that the first three articles were on carbon dioxide laser for lichen sclerosis. There was also an editorial talking about them. They're not long, they're definitely worth reading, but I'm gonna summarize them for you here. So the CO2 fractionated laser is 10,600 nanometers of a superficial micro ablation. So you don't get a super deep burn with the fractionated laser. It's a pulsed beam, so that avoids overheating. And it is fractionated, so that's shown here. So you get some areas that are treated and some areas that are not. And they're right next to each other. So this results in production of heat shock proteins and is thought to stimulate new collagen, fibroblasts, and ground matrix that results in healing. So in these two studies, the first study is shown above. So they did three courses of the fractionated laser, and that on the popsicle stick, it shows you what that pattern looked like. And the second study, they did five treatments. And then the box is the sham laser. So they did head-to-head comparison between the fractionated laser and the sham laser. And you can see the sham laser, if you look closely, does produce some effect on the skin, but it's not the same as the actual laser. So in the first study, Burkett and al. Randomized 52 women to clobetasol for 3 months, and then the three treatments of the CO2 laser 4 to 6 weeks apart. And they use the Skindex 29 score, which is a quality of life score, and compared those scores between the two groups. And the laser group reported more improvement in their symptoms, and that was statistically significant. However, the women in this study were recruited based on diagnosis of lichen sclerosis, and some of those women had already been using clobetasol. They did do a washout period, but some had previously been treated and others had not. So when they stratified based on the use of steroids, they found that the improvement in symptoms was only seen in the group that had previously used steroids. In terms of side effects, there was a patient in the laser group that reported a burn and poor wound healing that improved with clobetasol. And then there was a woman in the steroid group that developed an HSV outbreak a week after starting. So that was considered an adverse event. So the authors concluded that laser therapy works, but it may be best as an adjuvant to clobetasol, since they really only saw improvement in women who had previously used clobetasol. So I just wanted to show you a picture from that study. This is a woman who's been treated with a laser. So this is A is pre-treatment and B is post-treatment after three treatments. And the authors say, you know, you get more elasticity of the tissue, maybe a little bit less blanching of the tissue. It looks like the caliber of the vagina might be a little bit better. And the editorial pointed out that the turgor, the pressure on the picture is not the same and the lighting's not the same. So, you know, it's maybe it's not the best representation of what a post laser vulva looks like, but it does give you an idea of the pre and post. So the other study was Mitchell and al, and they randomized 40 women to five sham laser treatments or actual fractionated CO2 treatments. And in this study, they biopsied pre and post. So they have a histopathology score for those biopsies. And what they wanted to do was show an improvement in the histopathology score. They also used a clinical scoring system that combined patients' perception of their disease and the clinician's perception of their disease and compared those pre and post. And they concluded that fractionated laser is not an effective monotherapy for lichen sclerosis. Their scores did not change significantly pre and post. There was some improvement with the actual group, but they weren't statistically significant. So just wanted to move on to lichen planus and trying to keep an eye on the time. So lichen planus causes itching and pain. And I do have some pictures here. Lichen planus is a hard one. So lichen sclerosis, you can treat them with clobetasol. We have some other treatments that I just mentioned. But lichen planus is, it's painful. The dermatologist that I work with says, I will trade you 10 lichen sclerosis patients for one lichen planus patient. It's important to tell patients when they're diagnosed with lichen planus, kind of what to expect. For these patients, we don't see remission. We can make their symptoms better, but they're gonna fluctuate. And so it's important, I think, to set expectations when they're first diagnosed. So lichen planus, like I said, itching and pain, and there can be vaginal involvement. About 40% of erosive lichen planus patients will have vaginal involvement. So it's important to do a speculum exam and see if they have involvement in the vagina. Some patients can also have vaginal involvement by itself. So if someone presents with complaints of bleeding and or pain with intercourse, that's, you know, we do an exam, that's what we do, but that might be something that you see, and I have some pictures. So treatment, vulvar care, and clobetasol, we do the twice daily for this, and then once daily for 4 weeks. And then they also should stay on maintenance. And their maintenance may be a little bit more than the lichen sclerosis group. They may be using it 3 to 4 times a week for their maintenance. These patients usually will get fissures, and again, we use the mupirocin for that. I put fluconazole question mark. There's been a study that showed that women who are treated with who have lichen planus respond to fluconazole or anti-yeast treatments, and in our practice, if we have any suspicion for yeast involvement, we put them on the fluconazole, the twice weekly for a week, and then once weekly for 6 weeks. Again, yeast makes everything worse. And so as long as they're healthy, don't have liver disease, a short course of fluconazole is not going to hurt. And then if they have vaginal involvement, they should do hydrocortisone suppositories. There's a few different ways to do that, but you can use the rectal suppositories and have them put them in the vagina. So here's a patient with lichen planus. She has the classic fissures on the perineum. And, you know, obviously your eye is kind of drawn to that when you initially do her exam, but this is where a camera can be really helpful. If you take a picture of the vulva and can kind of blow it up with your finger, then you can really see, oh yeah, that is a fissure. I can really see what's going on. Maybe it's just me with my changing vision in my 40s, but this is, I think it's really helpful. I do note that a lot of EMRs will have the capability of taking a photo directly from the medical record. So we use Epic at UVA, and you can just pull it up on your phone, and then it goes directly into their chart, and it doesn't stay on your phone. So definitely would recommend something like that for these patients. It just helps you remember, this is what their vulva looked like the last time I saw them. And, you know, no drawing in the world is going to capture exactly what this looks like. This is a patient who doesn't have vulvar lichen planus, but she does have vaginal involvement of her lichen planus. So you can see some erosions in the vaginal mucosa. And this is her cervix. So not the best picture, but she has an erosion here on her cervix. And so she's somebody that we would put on hydrocortisone in the vagina. Just as a reminder, lichen planus often will have oral involvement, and this is what this looks like. In our patients, we, you know, generally ask, do they have any oral lesions? Sometimes we'll look at the gums. I don't really look at mouths, but, you know, if you see white things along the gum line, it kind of raises your suspicion. Obviously, a lot of patients don't like their vulva biopsied, so a gingival biopsy is often more acceptable. So sometimes we'll refer them to a periodontist if they have what looks like oral lichen planus and make the diagnosis that way. They can also have it in other places. This is a picture of a back with lichen planus. So it's not uncommon that these patients are not going to get better with just clobetasol. If they're really not doing well, consider oral prednisone for an intense flare, and there's a taper there. Again, the intramuscular or intralesional triamcinolone can also be helpful monthly for 3 to 4 months. And then tacrolimus, in our office, we use it for maintenance rather than flares, especially if they have fissures. We try to get that under control with the clobetasol first and then put them on the tacrolimus. Lichen planus, as I said, is a really hard one, and this is definitely one that you want to involve your friendly dermatologist. There are other therapies out there, and I've listed them here, but generally we refer to dermatology to prescribe those, and they often will have extragenital lichen planus, and so dermatology is the one that's going to manage those. So beyond the lichens, I wanted to talk a little bit about this, but I also wanted to leave time for questions and wanted to make sure that I focused on those three things. In your handout, I do have some treatments for psoriasis, which is relatively common, and hidradenitis suppurativa, something that we see all the time. The vulvar care handout is where you want to go to just get that information. And hopefully that will be helpful for you. And then I also included in the handout some treatment algorithms for vulvodynia. Often patients with vulvar dermatosis may also have vulvodynia. Remember, vulvodynia is 3 months of vulvar pain without any other findings. But if you've managed the lichen sclerosis, the exam is improving and they still continue to have pain, you may want to think about vulvodynia. Usually there's some sort of inciting event with vulvodynia as well. And sometimes it's a vulvar dermatosis. So there's, again, a treatment or a diagnosis algorithm and some treatment options for vulvodynia in the handout that I hope you find helpful. And there's some references. So I'm going to turn it back over to Rebecca, who I think has some questions to start off.
I do. Hello. Sorry, we have audience members in the background
watching your presentation.
So thank you so much for that. I think amazing information. I think this is an area that so many gynecologists really, really, really struggle with. It's just hard and very specialized. So there are a couple questions we've sort of come up with ahead of time that I want to go over with you. And then we also have questions coming in. So I want to remind the audience that there is a way to ask questions. There's a question tab and you can put questions into there and I can read them out and we can answer them both live and via the question app. So a couple of just upfront questions. You know, we talked about, you talked a couple places about biopsying for lichen sclerosis or other disorders, but there are lots of ways to do this. So how do you guys do it at UVA? What's your recommended system for doing that?
So the first thing I think that's important is setting the patient up with the expectation that there might be a biopsy. And so, you know, the patients, especially at a multidisciplinary clinic, oftentimes patients have seen other doctors, they may have already had a biopsy. And so they come in and they're super anxious because we think we're going to poke them again. So sometimes the first time we just look and talk and then we say, okay, it's not going to be better. Then we're going to do a biopsy. And I do that in my general practice too. I'm a generalist. You know, I see something, as long as I'm pretty convinced it's not cancer, then oftentimes I'll say, okay, we're going to try this and see if it, you know, if it improves. And if it doesn't, then you're going to come back anyway in 4 to 6 weeks. And then we may do a biopsy. And that gives me a little bit more time also to make sure they have the correct amount of time for their appointment to do a procedure. So setting the patient up, if they think they're going to be anxious about having a biopsy, sometimes an anxiolytic can be helpful. And then in terms of the actual biopsy, I inject whatever I have. Oftentimes lidocaine, and I don't always use epinephrine, but that's going to result in a little bit longer pain control. And then I generally use a punch, a 3 or 4 millimeter punch. You can also use a Tischler, so what you would normally use for a cervical biopsy. But I find that's better if there's kind of an edge, you know, if there's something to kind of grab onto. Just like a flat vulva is going to be hard to get tissue with the Tischler. And then you can certainly use some topical gel or Emla cream first before the injection to try to make it better. In my experience, it hasn't really helped. So I usually just do the injection.
I was gonna jump in there and just say that my partner and I out here in Seattle, we have found that using topical BLT cream, so the benzocaine, lidocaine, tetracaine compounded for about 5 to 10 minutes before really does help. Often we can do the biopsy without any injected numbing, but if we can't, it at least helps with the injection. But you need the strong.
I'm writing that down.
The topical Emla isn't gonna do it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the other thing I was going to say is about hemostasis. The dermatologist I work with is very particular about what we do after we take the biopsy. So she likes to use Drysol ointment, which is just a hemostatic agent. It works really well. It doesn't bother patients. She says in her practice that she has lots of patients who come in after a vulvar biopsy by a gynecologist who were treated with silver nitrate and they have tattooing of the skin, which they complain of more pain from the silver nitrate. And I think we've certainly seen that in practice. So I try to avoid silver nitrate if I can. Moncels also, if I don't have the Drysol, I'll use the Moncels. And try to use pressure. You can put a stitch in if you want, but oftentimes that will just bother them even a little bit more.
Great. For all of these, you know, we tend to consider the lichens autoimmune disorders. Do you think that systemic biologics have any role, and do we have any data for that?
So there definitely is a lot of association between the lichens and other autoimmune disorders. So yes, we think that there's probably a connection there. I don't know that it's been firmly established. So I mentioned some of the biologics for treatment of lichen planus, and all of the studies are pretty small, mostly case series, case reports, mm-hmm. especially amongst patients who have other symptoms or you know, extragenital lesions. Some case reports of intralesional adalimumab, mycophenolate mofetil and erosive lichen planus. So there's definitely is some data there. For me as a generalist, I kind of defer those to the dermatologist in our practice who prescribes those. I'm not at the point that I feel comfortable with those yet, just in terms of the monitoring. But yes, I think they play a role, but just don't have great randomized control trials yet.
In one of your in your first lichen slide, you said something about cure rates of 23% to 54%. In your practice, do you actually see that high of a rate of actually resolving their lichen sclerosis?
I would say yes and no. And it depends on what clinic I'm in. So as a generalist who's newly diagnosing some patients, you know, just doing their annual exam and I'm like, what's this? Or they come in because they've found a spot or they have a specific spot that's itching, then I do see cure rates that high. But it's generally because they just have one area and they respond well to clobetasol. And then we talk about maintenance and they really don't have a lot of flares. But when I see patients in my multidisciplinary clinic, those are patients who already have scarring, they have lots of architecture, they have a neuroentroitis, they've already been tried on multiple things. And so those patients don't have that kind of cure rate. Those are more patients that you're just trying to manage the flares, keep, you know, the maintenance going, and trying to set expectations. And I think that's reflected in the literature that patients who already, you know, present with scarring generally don't have those kind of cure rates.
Great. We got a question that was sent in asking how long a woman should be off steroids before biopsying the vulva.
I don't know that there's a set time. If they can wait, you know, a couple of days, a week or two, that's great. Again, another time to kind of set up a patient for a biopsy at their next visit and make that recommendation. Sometimes steroids can kind of mask what's going on at a histopathologic level. And so you may do a biopsy and get nothing, and that's frustrating. Yes, if you can keep the patient off for a week or two before the biopsy, I think that's advisable.
Great, and I wanna encourage people to send in your questions. I have a couple more, but I wanna make sure we get to everybody's questions and issues. Somebody did ask us to repeat the name of the hemostatic cream, and I typed in Drysol, which is Drysol, is that correct?
Yeah, and I have a picture of it. I don't know if you can bring the slides up again, let's see. I put it on my last slide there, yeah. This is a picture I took from my clinic because I was like, what is this? I've never heard of it before. The dermatologist I work with is always kind of, is always pulling out things for me to use. So this is one that I really like.
Oh, interesting. I was going to say one of the things we're seeing more and more is Arista being translated into different settings. So using it in the vagina for post-OB hemorrhage might be interesting to try that as well. That's the potato starch hemostatic agent. Might work well.
Yeah.
And it's very non-reactive.
Yeah.
So if you're a generalist OBGYN and you want to become more comfortable with this, not necessarily an expert or run a clinic, where do you go? What are great training resources? You know, who do you think sort of has a good maybe weekend course, anything like that?
Yeah, I guess I can only recommend what I did initially. As I mentioned, I always had an interest in this. And so I always sign up for Dr. Hefner's course, like pre-ASCCP course. And she always does like vulvar disorders. And then often she'll do one at ACOG as well. And there's a couple of other people in that mix that do them. So I just kind of gravitate to those courses. And I think just looking at pictures and trying to make a diagnosis and then seeing if the presenter tells you that you're right is really helpful. So I would recommend ASCCP and ACOG meetings and pre-conference courses. The other thing is having a dermatologist that you work with. So as you don't have to have a multidisciplinary clinic, it's helpful, but it's not realistic for everybody. But having somebody in your community that has some interest in vulvar skin disorders or feels comfortable managing patients with lichen sclerosus, lichen planus, even if it's just the extragenital things, I think is really helpful. It's really, as I mentioned, it's important that lichen planus patients have a vaginal exam. So often you can kind of present it as, you know, send me your patients that need rule in or rule out for vaginal involvement. And they oftentimes don't like doing vulvar biopsies. They'll biopsy anything else, but they don't want to biopsy the vulva or the vagina. So you can kind of, you know, make friends with one who might need your services, and then kind of can bounce things off of each other. So just, you know, learning from another person who, there's really a lot of crossover there.
Yeah.
It's been really helpful.
I think there is. We got a question in, do you ever use aluminum chloride as a hemostatic agent?
No, but I feel like the dermatologist that I work with has mentioned that to me before, but we always go for the dry salt. But yes, I've heard of that, but I don't often use it.
I have not heard of using that on the vulva. Well, I'm waiting to see if there are any more questions that come in, but one sort of last thing, I think if you want to give us just sort of a couple of minutes on the vulvodynia side, because I know that's a huge issue for many people, both diagnosis and treatment of vulvodynia. And I had you sort of take some of that out of your talk just in the interest of time, but I know it's still in there somewhere. And I thought people would probably really appreciate hearing sort of just some very basics about that, even though it's in the slides that you gave us as a handout.
Yeah, it's not.
Sorry, I've sprung that on you.
Let me see. No, it's okay. I had a feeling that might happen.
Yeah.
Give me 2 seconds, and I probably can open the original one and just give you the end of it. Okay. And, you know, obviously I don't have a lot of great pictures for that one, but as I mentioned, 3 months. Right, here we go. Can you see that?
Yes.
Okay.
We can.
So 3 months of vulvar pain without an identifiable cause is diagnosed using the Q-tip test. So you take your, you know, cotton-tipped applicator and start at the inner thigh. Does this hurt? Does this hurt? You know, does it reproduce your pain? Work your way in labia majora, labia minora, and the vestibule. And then you want to also assess the pelvic floor since they're complaining of pelvic pain. And that should be last. And then a fungal culture. So anytime, you know, you're thinking, okay, this might be vulvodynia. I've got my, you know, Q-tip here. You should also do a fungal culture. And the reason for this is I use this article from the Journal of Lower Genital Tract Disease. It's a little bit dated now, but it still holds true. It's from 2005, it's not that old. But if they have any visible condition, obviously you're gonna treat that. We've talked about those. You do your cotton swab and you do your yeast culture. If it's positive, you're gonna treat that in the same treatment that we talked about for lichen sclerosis, lichen planus. If that doesn't fix things, then this box here, the vulvar care measures, topical medications, oral medications, injections, biofeedback. So again, the vulvar care instructions that you have, I think are super important. I didn't say this in the beginning, but it's really helpful if you make a dot phrase or whatever you use in your EMR, or just have a handout on this, and then you can write in the things that you want people to do. It's just, you're gonna give the patient a lot of information, so having it written down is really helpful. So we talk about vulvar care, we talk about sitz baths. This is also important for vulvodynia, even if they have a normal exam. Water is soothing, it's also cleansing, and so they really can get benefit from doing the sitz baths. Again, talk about irritants, and then treat the yeast. So one thing we generally start with is lidocaine. If you can get 5% lidocaine ointment, that's great. If you can't get the jelly, that's pretty universally available, the 2% jelly. They can apply it prior to intercourse. So we usually say 30 minutes before, when the partner may have numbness from that, they can try using condoms. They can also use it for desensitization. So nightly soaked in a cotton ball for 6 weeks can help. And then compounded creams, this is the one that Dr. Hefner recommends. I've also just used 2 agents at once, or even one agent at once, if I think the patient's gonna be really sensitive to one thing, or we just don't wanna mix too much at once, but we kind of work our way up to this. They can use this 1 to 3 times a day. It's important to have a compounding pharmacy that you can work with. There's lots of mail order ones, but I usually just call the pharmacist and say, okay, these are the things that I want. And how much is it going to cost? How many do they get? And then check with the patient and make sure that that's acceptable to her. And then we prescribe it. And usually the pharmacist will mail it. Estrogen, especially if they're postmenopausal, that can be helpful. Sometimes it's not, but again, usually doesn't hurt to try it. And then if you're moving on to oral treatment, I mentioned this before for lichen planus, but and sometimes for lichen simplex chronicus, amitriptyline, and the dosages are here. You tell patients it's going to take a little while to see an effect, and they're always going to ask about side effects, so fatigue, weight gain, constipation, and dry mouth. And then I've had a lot of good success with gabapentin, and so I usually will kind of start with that, and if that doesn't help, then try the amitriptyline or the duloxetine, the SNRI. And just remember, for gabapentin, again, you have to titrate up and then off again if it's not working. So other things to think about are pelvic floor PT. I sent all of these patients to pelvic floor PT. They, I think more than anything, this is where they get the greatest effect. Again, cognitive behavior therapy or sex therapy or both can also be helpful. And then there's some mention in the literature of low oxalate diet. This is more like you think about for IC, but there might be some benefit. And so many patients will ask me, "Was it? Can I do something different in my diet?" I don't think it hurts to recommend this. And then localized treatments would be trigger point injections. And that can be, you know, in the one spot that hurts, or it can be a pudendal block. Dr. Hefner talks about Botox. I haven't done it, but it kind of makes sense if that will help relax some of the muscles. And then vestibulectomy, if you can refer to someone who does it or want to learn how to do it, that can be 60 to 70% effective for patients with localized vulvodynia. So it can be a good treatment, but you just want to know what you're doing. And that's not it. And that was the last thing about vulvodynia.
Great. Just a couple other things have come up in the questions. One that's come up a couple times is good resources for pictures of these vulvar skin disorders on women of color.
Yes, I tried to include a few. I'm still coming up with my own library, but there are, I use ASCCP and their image library, and then ISHWISH, the International Society for Vulvovaginal Disorders. They also have a library, and there's not a ton of pictures, but there are some for women of color, and things will often look, you know, not exactly the same as it will in somebody who doesn't have pigmented skin. And so, again, taking a biopsy, if you're not sure, is so important.
And then the last question that came up was, do you have any information on plasma cell vulvitis? Or I think they called it Noon vulvitis.
I don't have a lot. I know the dermatologist I work with was talking to me about it a few months ago. Is it Noonan's? And wanted me, my help to, you know, rule it in or rule it out. And unfortunately, I don't, beyond, it's rare. But no, I don't have any magic treatments.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for this. I think we had a great attendance and people really will benefit from this. And thank you so much for also leaving your handout. I think everyone should download that before they go, because it's just having all these like tips and tricks and things to work through is really key in helping patients. And if you can find a vulvovaginal specialties clinic near you, obviously you've got a great referral pattern, but many people don't have that access. So
yeah.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Well,
good
thank
night.
You. Have a good night. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.